Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Hi, and welcome to the Currency podcast with Ed Brophy. The reluctance to historicise current events has really been swept away by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. If, in the words of Konrad Adenauer, the first Chancellor of Germany, history is a sum total of things that could have been avoided, then Putin's war of choice has forced the West to confront questions it has long avoided about its economic relationship with Russia. To get a better understanding of the consequences of the West's economic war against Russia, I'm delighted to welcome to the Currency Podcast Nicholas Mulder, assistant professor in the History Department of Cornell University in New York and author of the superb recent book, The Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War, a timely and original history of the use of economic sanctions as a form of war and their unintended consequences. Nicholas Mulder, welcome to the Currency Podcast.
Very glad to be here, Ed.
Nicholas, in The Economic Weapon, you write about the history of sanctions, and you say that the founders of the League of Nations were, you know, after the First World War and after the Treaty of Versailles, sanctions became first something that came to light. They believed that they'd equipped the organization with a new and powerful kind of coercive instrument for the modern world, and that instrument was sanctions. And you quote Woodrow Wilson, U.S. president, as describing sanctions as something more tremendous than war. In a subsequent article then in Foreign Affairs, you described the Russia-Ukrainian War of 2022 as a geoeconomic turning point, writing, "A few weeks ago, it would have seemed unimaginable that the world's 11th largest economy would have been decoupled from the 21st century globalization." And I'm just wondering, given that history and given what we're seeing at the moment, you know, have Western sanctions unleashed something more tremendous than war, in Wilson's words, on Russia? And if so, can you put the significance of this geoeconomic turning point, as you call it, in some kind of historical context?
Yes. So these sanctions on Russia are really tremendous and unprecedented in many ways in a variety of dimensions. The first is, like you mentioned, the size of Russia as an economy. This, in recent history, hasn't really been applied in any real sense to an economy that's in the top 20 in the G20. But also the number of countries involved. It's not just the entire EU and United States, but also a number of key Asian allies, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. So all together about 37 countries. And that makes the sanctions coalition a much wider one than was in effect previously in the case of, for example, sanctions against Iran or sanctions on Venezuela. And all those things put together, and then also the speed with which these sanctions have been used, I think you can really say that we're in new territory. This hasn't been done before. It was also, of course, done in a moment of great haste and urgency in order to respond and punish something that was equally shocking and unprecedented, which is Putin's aggressive invasion of Ukraine. Mm. So it's very understandable that we went from zero to 60, so to speak, very quickly. But I do think that there's a lot of things right now going on that we have to keep a careful eye on, because at this scale, we haven't really been using sanctions in the last few decades at all. So there's also a little experience, I think, among policymakers with the wider ramifications that this might have.
And when you talk about those wider ramifications, I think if you look back historically, and it's very much a recurring theme in The Economic Weapon, the policymakers and politicians at that time, after the First World War in Versailles, you know, they saw the economic weapon, as you write in the book, as the very essence of total war, whereas I think today sanctions are regarded as an alternative to war. But to the interwar internationalists that you write about in The Economic Weapon, sanctions were actually a form of deterrence, prefiguring nuclear strategy during the Cold War. So I just wonder how we've come to a situation where sanctions have become viewed more as a surgical, precise instrument rather than that earlier understanding of them as the very essence of all-out war. And like, if that's the case, are we complacent about the nature and kind of sanctions we've imposed on Russia and their potential consequences?
Yeah, so one thing to realize is that the interwar internationalists, the people in and around the League of Nations who first made sanctions this international policy instrument between the world wars, they lived in a world that was already very globalized in many ways like our own, but they did also live in a world before nuclear weapons. And I think if you want to make sense of why we see sanctions as relatively mild, we have an imagination about how destructive war could be, you know, going up to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and atomic war, that is really awesome in the old-fashioned sense of the word. And compared to that, I think economic pressure seems relatively mild. But before you had nuclear weapons, actually, economic pressure was always an essential part of any major war. And in the early 20th century, it in fact was the main way that countries, particularly in World War I, were able to kill or put pressure on civilians. And so in World War I, that's probably the main man-made cause of civilian death,
right?
Economic blockade. And I think that that's something that, you know, since then, of course, we've had World War II, genocide, Auschwitz, Hiroshima, sort of our moral intuitions for how far you can go have been shocked by what happened subsequently. And since then, I think we see sanctions as relatively mild. Yeah.
And we see them as mild, yes, we do. But we also see it as not very clear really necessarily how they work. And I mean, this is another key theme of what you write. Sanctions on blockades don't always work as predictably or as effectively as their proponents would suggest. The more powerful sanctions are, the greater the danger that they will lead to an unpredictable response. And you show, for example, in the book, how the fear of sanctions helped propel Nazi Germany's territorial ambitions. So, I mean, I suppose it's the question really about kind of escalation, and it's the question of kind of the aims of sanctions. But do you believe that the closer our sanctions bring, you know, Russia's economy and Putin's regime to collapse, that the more likely that this then leads to escalation? And it is more similar to the conception of the impact of sanctions from that earlier historical period.
I think there's definitely things that we can learn from the earlier period that are relevant today. I don't want to draw too close a comparison between Putin and some of these interwar regimes, for one reason, because I think the interwar fascist and militarist regimes had a really radical ideology that made them even more, I think, concerned with hanging on to territory and seeing conquest as a way that you could actually ensure the economic survival of a population. I'm not quite sure whether that's the same with Putin, but he certainly will not act in a predictable way when put under pressure. And so I think it is safe to assume that at some point there is a point where putting further pressure on him is going to lead to escalation. And I think it's worth keeping that in mind, because so far, at least, I think most people have seen sanctions as a relatively weaker thing than what could be done. But actually, in terms of putting pressure on Russia as a whole, they're a pretty serious instrument that we're using right now. And they're also obviously affecting ordinary Russians in ways that might make them support Putin more. We just don't really know, because we don't have that accurate information on public opinion. But the risk historically has been that severe economic pressure creates a sort of rally around the flag effect. And that might also enable Putin to undertake escalatory action without really suffering for it in the eyes of the Russian public.
And that perception of sanctions as something for which there's, you know, you don't pay a very high price, I think is behind some of this talk that we see in the West at the moment about the intensification of sanctions. But that talk about the intensification of sanctions comes without any real, you know, discussion that I can see about the ultimate aims of these sanctions. So we see a lot of discussion about Russia's shifting war aims in terms of what it's trying to achieve in Ukraine. We see much less talk about the West's war aims when it comes to the economic war. And we've been reluctant to discuss that. But to my mind, there can only really be three aims of the sanctions. One is to stop the war. The other is to stop Russia from going further, or else, you know, regime change or regime wrecking, if you want to call it that, in Russia. And I'm just wondering, do you think the West has really thought this through in terms of the aims of its economic war? And has it retained enough strategic flexibility to vary those aims over time?
So I think you're right that when these sanctions were imposed pretty quickly at the end of February and in early March, there was a need to act. And I also think that that's understandable and totally justified, right? This is the sort of aggressive invasion that you just cannot let this go unpunished. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a debate about which measures are better and worse to take. And I think that that debate needs to be had right now. also to provide clarity, and yes, to think about what sort of an outcome can you achieve here where Ukraine's independence is preserved, but you also don't escalate the situation where you're going to end up in a permanently elevated state of military confrontation with Russia for decades and decades to come. That certainly has all sorts of costs down the line that we can't even really fathom at the moment, particularly in terms of dealing with other global challenges. But I think most of the leaders who imposed sanctions in the West earlier this month and last month probably thought, you know, they need to respond first, understandably so. But then they would leave it kind of in the middle what the aims were. And I think you can start to see now that there isn't necessarily a unified understanding or an agreement on it. Biden, in his State of the Union, said that the aim was indeed to just impose costs. Mm-hmm. He seemed to not really leave any door open to compromise or even expect a change in Russian behavior. But then Blinken, the Secretary of State of the U.S., and also Victoria Nuland, who's an Undersecretary of State, they have mentioned sanctions relief only to say that they don't think it's on the table now. And then if you go to European leaders right there, Macron and others have been probably the most compromise-oriented. So within the sanctions imposing coalition, there's a big spectrum of positions, all the way from the really, I think, the toughest position that they're not even going to expect any change in Putin's behavior, and there's not going to be anything that these sanctions are working towards other than just permanently weakening Russia, all the way to we should really use them very pragmatically and flexibly to get to a negotiated settlement.
Yes, and I mean, I think it's that kind of lack of clarity around the purpose of the sanctions that I think would cause, you know, some concern. I mean, even in the FT today, it's reported that Western capitals are united in imposing, you know, linking progress in the peace talks that are currently underway between Russia and Ukraine with the lifting of sanctions, and instead hold, you know, girding in for long-term economic pressure against Russia. And no debate on possible off-ramps or face-saving ways to de-escalate, you know, for Putin in response to the apparent progress during those peace talks. But, I mean, presumably sanctions have to play a part in any peace negotiations, because if sanctions are a form of war and the physical war and the conflict, the physical conflict in Ukraine is changing and developing, and, you know, there is some prospects of peace or a negotiated settlement, presumably you cannot have that without sanctions. I mean, you cannot expect, I guess, total surrender and humiliation of Russia. So presumably it has to be part of that. And I think this plays in some way into this issue that perhaps there's not a very sophisticated understanding now in the West about the extent to which sanctions are essentially weapons of war.
Yes, absolutely. And actually one interesting historical case right from the origins of sanctions is the continuation by the Allies of the blockade after the armistice that ended World War I. And what happened then is quite interesting, because traditionally speaking, once you agreed on a ceasefire, you also had to stop any kind of economic blockade. You could be totally ruthless as long as you were formally at war. But as soon as there was a ceasefire, these economic restrictions had to be lifted as well. And from November 1918 until the summer of 1919, when the Allies were negotiating the Treaty of Versailles, they did keep up the economic pressure on Germany. And that was actually a real first. And I think it explains some of the bad blood, obviously, between the Allies and Germany in the 1920s, created by that, the first time that they continued this and kept on the thumbscrews effectively in an effort to get Germany to agree to this treaty. Now, that I think is one issue. And what you saw at that time also was that there was a big debate in Allied capitals about should you let through humanitarian aid? Because actually, if you keep on the pressure, you might be furthering the collapse of all of these European societies. They might fall to Bolshevism and, cast in their lot with the Russian communists. So even Winston Churchill, for example, was eventually became kind of a moderate, not because he liked communism, but simply because he thought that the costs of keeping the pressure on and the risks of it were much higher than lifting some of it, also to show some goodwill to the Germans.
Yes, and I think there's a little bit of an absence of that kind of thinking at the moment, because inevitably at some stage the war will end, and part of the ending of the war will have to be an ongoing relationship with Russia, if it's a relationship with Russia that is characterized by, you know, humiliation and ongoing economic pressure. then surely we are storing up the pressure, or you know, paving the way to ongoing hostilities. And I guess that lesson from history should be front and center in the thinking of policymakers and politicians in the West today, with that in mind.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, we can see how that will pan out as it happens. But the other thing that we need to, I think, be aware of is it's very easy when there's a shocking event like this to have a quick response. It's impressive that there was such a unified response in terms of sanctions. Mm-hmm. But what we do also know about sanctions is that even with, for example, the sanctions against Iran, within a single government like the United States government, the different agencies in the government took months and years actually to agree on the precise conditions to lift sanctions on Iran. If you just imagine what the process looks like when you have 27 EU member states,
yeah,
and then another 10 non-EU states, 37 capitals trying to all reach agreement on the exact conditions for lifting. I mean, it's just a political minefield. Certain countries are likely to accuse others of being too soft or being too harsh. So I think that, you know, having kicked that can down the road, we do really need to think ahead about how are we going to create some sort of common guidelines for agreeing on when the purpose of the sanctions has been served, precisely so we can kind of cash in the political and strategic gains from them.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Nicholas, perhaps the most remarkable aspect, to my mind, of the sanctions regime has been the freezing by the West of nearly half of Russia's foreign exchange reserves. And I think the implications of this move for other states that hold large external reserves are profound and raise questions about the future, potentially, of the dollar as a global reserve currency. Zoltan Pozsar of Credit Suisse has argued that this will create what he calls unhedgeable confiscation risks for sovereign states. And I'm just wondering what you think are the implications for the global financial system of such unprecedented action with regard to foreign reserves.
Yes, I mean, that's really the interesting space to watch at this moment. And I think Zoltan's note on this expressed people's shock, right, at thinking through the potential consequences. I do think now it's clear that there isn't yet an immediate move away from the dollar by as many countries as some may have feared. Mm. But I do think that there are serious effects for the international monetary system, but they're probably a bit less dramatic than a loss of reserve currency status by the dollar. And part of that is, I think, that we're also, as people like Barry Eichengreen have argued, we're projecting a model onto the future. Our expectations are based on the idea that whichever currency will be the next reserve currency will have a status and a dominance like that of the dollar.
But yes,
it might be much more likely that we're actually going to just end up in a more fragmented world of regionalized currency use, where the dollar might still be kind of a plurality, you know, a first among equals of currencies. So I think that's quite a likely outcome. Also because, yeah, the yuan of China doesn't really have the characteristics that you need for a properly liquid global reserve currency. Mm. My sense also of what the an immediate short-term effect will be is that you'll start to see countries like Russia and China, as they already are, beginning to switch away from the dollar, not for reserves necessarily, but particularly for trade settlements.
Okay.
And I think it's important to distinguish those two things, because one of the things that these central bank sanctions have shown is that maybe having large amounts of reserves actually isn't that useful, right, in general, because what use are these reserves if they're there just to reassure financial markets that your currency can be supported in time of need?
Yeah.
But then if something politically happens in geopolitics, you might lose access. So what countries, of course, do still want is the ability to just pay for imports. Hmm. And I think in that sense, it'll be much more likely that you start to see these things like bilateral clearing mechanisms, like the rupee ruble, or these talks that there are now of the Saudis perhaps selling their oil to the Chinese in yuan instead of in dollars. Those sorts of things continue to give access to what you actually need foreign exchange reserves for, or what you need foreign currency for, which is just to pay for imports that are not from your own country.
But surely the whole kind of you know, U.S. Treasury system is predicated on you know, foreign sovereigns buying U.S. T-bills and you know, holding dollar foreign reserves and that kind of thing. And if there's a move away from that, surely that is a very significant, you know, creates an imbalance or certainly a kind of a disruption within the international financial system.
Yes, now that I think that is definitely a more slow burning risk that we just don't really know enough about who holds these very large dollar securities or who has lent out a lot of their FX reserves in swap markets, for example. And I think that's what Zoltan Pozsar was very, really concerned about, right? That Russia had $300 billion perhaps in foreign currency swaps, and overnight it turned from a surplus into a deficit agent. China has $1 trillion, I think, in U.S. securities. So the shocks to the global treasury market and repo market of freezing or confiscating China's dollar assets, you just really don't know where the problem is going to emerge once you hit that, essentially.
Absolutely. And I guess like 2008, it wasn't until we, you know, saw what the problem was that it was almost almost too late. And I think China is, you know, very much key to this story. I mean, to the extent that China has featured in the Ukraine-Russia war, it's been around what side it would take. Would it take the side of Russia or the West? But I think another aspect of this is China's view of the economic war and sanctions. And I was very struck by a speech that the Vice Foreign Minister Li Yucheng made recently on its view on sanctions, where he stated that globalization should not be weaponized. And he went on to argue that unilateral sanctions have neither basis in international law nor the mandate of the Security Council. History has shown time and time again that instead of solving problems, imposing sanctions is like putting out fire with firewood and will only make things worse. The abuse of sanctions will bring catastrophic consequences for the entire world. So that's the Chinese vice foreign minister. And I guess what that brings to mind is that, you know, there are very different global perspectives on this. And unlike other kind of global questions like the use of nuclear weapons or maybe pandemics or international financial frameworks, there's no real international consensus on the use of sanctions as a weapon of war. There was perhaps back in 1919 with the League of Nations, but I'm just wondering, in the aftermath of Ukraine, do we urgently need to develop such a consensus for the future on the use of these economic weapons?
I think it would be important to do so, particularly to try and shore up the legitimacy of this. If we agree that it is important to have some instrument stronger than mere diplomatic pressure and weaker than direct military force, or, you know, it's where it's possible to adjust it to be weaker than military force, then we might still have to use sanctions, right? I think that there are certainly cases where we could defend that. However, in this globalized world, particularly one where today Asia and the global south and the developing world are a much larger share of global GDP than they were in the early 20th century when sanctions were first designed, we just need to care about what these countries think. And their view really matters. If they do not agree with this, we could still exploit, obviously, and the US seems to still be capable of exploiting dollar dominance, but at what political cost, I think, right? This is, there will be all sorts of other political issues that as a result will not be solved, and you cannot keep doing that indefinitely. So there is a legitimacy problem that needs active work, and I think international law coming up for with common guidelines for how to use sanctions will be vital in that sense. So yeah, I agree with you.
It cuts both ways though as well. I mean, we have seen an extraordinary situation in Europe recently where China, before the Ukraine war, kind of was waging its own form of, if not economic war, but certainly economic kind of conflict with a very small European country, Lithuania. And that was because Lithuania had, you know, opened a Taiwan representative office in Lithuania, which went against China's, you know, one China policy. But, you know, it went further than that because it then insisted that, you know, any, you know, companies in the European single market would be kind of impacted by that. In other words, that they couldn't really deal with Lithuania. So German manufacturers couldn't trade with Lithuania without falling foul of this regime. But it had never been, it was never actually officially declared as sanctions. So it was kind of all measures short of sanctions or all measures short of economic war, but still had a very significant effect. So, I mean, while China is on one hand, you know, concerned and obviously making very strong statements about the use of sanctions by the West in the current Ukraine-Russia war, China itself, you know, is quite capable of weaponizing globalization as well.
Absolutely. And they also used it against Australia a year and a half ago, right, with stopping their purchase of Australian coal to retaliate against Australia, suggesting that, you know, there should be investigations into the Wuhan lab leak theory and these sorts of things. So in that case, China suffers, you know, or I think is discovering that sanctions can backfire. And certainly in the case of Australia, they did, if the hope was that Australia would lie down and submit to Chinese economic and political demands, then it was a clear failure, because I think Australia now is much more unified in resisting this sort of coercion by China. So the rally around the flag effect is not just something that happens as a result of Western sanctions. It also happens when China is going to do that more and more.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, in a foreign affairs piece, then a recent foreign affairs piece, you wrote that, you know, part of the issue around sanctions is they may ultimately fail because they're too strong. You talk about fragilities in the world's economic and financial structure that mean that sanctions have the potential to cause grave political and material fallout. And there's also talk from people like Larry Fink, head of BlackRock, about the end of globalization. However, in the FT today, Thursday, Adam Tooze pushes back against this, arguing that when talking about supply chains, what does Putin's war in Ukraine really have to do with it, given that, you know, Russia's really not a big player in the kind of, you know, markets in the world outside of commodities. But I'm just wondering, if we assume that sanctions will persist, what do you see as the kind of economic and material fallout? Like, is the end, is talk of the end of globalization overstated, or is this just a more, you know, tense or, you know, frictional form of globalization we're about to see in the period ahead?
I think that the risk is not so much deglobalization, which suggests that we all return to our national borders and that our economies become these little fortresses. But at a larger scale, you might start to see something like bloc formation. Mm-hmm. I think that that is a realistic risk. And it will be slow. It will take time. There will still be trade between the blocs as well. But there will be an increasing sense of a kind of political unity and agreement on certain principles between these different blocs. And the question is, of course, where do many of the countries that don't fall into the US, China, EU large blocs come down, right? What would be the effect for them? Their economies are very dependent on the globalization as we've created it now, which is a more open one. So for them, I think the costs and the choices ahead are probably the most fraught with issues. They're also the easiest to pressure, right? So there will be all sorts of competition, I think, for their favor, but also lots of coercion being exerted on them. So I think that that's really the perspective I'm increasingly gravitating towards, that the majority of the world's countries stand to lose a lot, but they're just small countries and smaller economies that we don't ordinarily think of as mattering that much in these big geopolitical debates.
And these are kind of large, small countries as well, or small, large countries as well. Like, this is like the likes of Japan, the UK, which is not within the EU anymore, maybe Canada, these kind of, you know, significant G7 economies that will have to decide, I guess, ultimately, what block they're in within that more regionalized form of globalization.
Yes, I think particularly for a country like Japan, which has enormous amounts of foreign investment in East Asia, including, you know, being the largest foreign investor in China and in India. So for them, they are part of the Quad. They're part of a potentially democratic alliance against Chinese expansion. But economically speaking, they and the same goes for the South Koreans and the Taiwanese and the Singaporeans. They have a real interest in not having any confrontation with China break out in the sort of proper economic war or military sphere.
And I guess the question is then, are they part of the West, or what is the West anymore? I mean, one thing we have seen as well that has been remarkable, it's been probably equally remarkable, you know, as remarkable as the scale of the sanctions and the kind of character of some of the sanctions, has been the kind of the voluntary behavior of many Western firms that have pulled out of Russia, driven by what you describe as moral condemnation, reputational concerns, and outright panic. So a lot of companies just leaving Russia, exiting its economy, irrespective of whether they have to or not, based on sanctions regimes. So it's kind of like a privatization of sanctions, or a privatization of economic war. And I just wonder, and it's, I guess it's linked to the this idea of regional blocs and how globalization might evolve, but like, what are the implications for, you know, foreign investment and international business in general of this kind of, you know, privatization of sanctions and kind of voluntary war that they are fighting with Russia?
Well, that's, I think, one of the things that these Russian sanctions have really driven home with a vengeance, that one of the consequences of using sanctions that policymakers simply cannot control is overcompliance and, in a sense, overreactions by the private sector. And there, this exodus, more than 400 major firms having left from Russia, it's been really notable. And you can only imagine, right, what serious economic pressure on China will unleash in that regard. And there, the costs, even for the United States, would be very severe. So the U.S. Chamber of Commerce last year calculated that even a 50% reduction of the amount of American investment in China, so if half of the American stock of capital either is sold off or becomes irretrievable, that would knock 2.5 percentage points of American GDP.
My goodness.
That's only half of the American capital in China. So the full amount, a full decoupling, would actually directly send the U.S. economy into a recession. And then by extension, very clearly, the world as well. Mm-hmm. So the costs are tremendous. And what we've also seen in previous sanctions regimes, particularly Iran, has been a smaller size, but very important, I think, a case that we should be paying much more attention to. What the sanctions of the last decade against Iran have shown is that even when you have a successful deal like Obama and John Kerry negotiated in 2015, the JCPOA, the challenge is convincing private companies to return when the sanctions are lifted.
Yes.
Because there's still this overhang in compliance departments, but just a residual fear that they might be reimposed. And you can lift all the interstate restrictions. Governments can say, well, there's no impediment to returning to Iran or returning to Russia once they've behaved in the way that we want them to. But that doesn't add up to a convincing case for the private sector always. So we actually also need to think about how can governments actively incentivize that return, because without that return, the material benefits of sanctions relief are nil. And so the actual behavioral change effect of sanctions, the incentive structure of them, is destroyed as well, right? If the private sector doesn't move back, then promising sanctions relief to Putin right now is not going to matter, because he's not going to see any new investment.
Which is a huge problem for the future of the Russian economy, because even if the war ends and there is some off-ramp or scaling back of sanctions, I mean, the ability of Russia to attract foreign direct investment in the next couple of decades, I think, is going to be massively challenged for the reasons you describe, because, you know, private investors will just consider the risk too significant to invest there, and it'll divert investment elsewhere, which I think has very troubling implications for the stability of Russia and Russia's, you know, geopolitical impact. You know, very large continental landmass like Russia with such a fundamentally weakened economy and a lack of foreign direct investment is a very concerning and troubling prospect.
Yes, and it's also useful maybe to compare this to debt default. So many countries, right, that are unable to pay off their debts and default, there it's really striking that after just several months, most international investors always flock back to those countries, because there's a restructuring, and fundamentally investors are forward-looking. They care about future payment streams. But with sanctions, this confiscation risk or this interdiction risk is there permanently, and it might involve all of the assets. So it fundamentally calls into question the ability to have payment streams for many of these countries in the future.
Yes.
The ability to transact them, the ability to send payments even. And in that sense, I think it's a much more fundamental risk to the world economy than simply debt default.
That risk to the world economy is something I'm just keen to just explore a little bit more now and probe a little bit more now. Because we talked about, I guess, the impact on Russia and the impact on the war and on geopolitics, but the impact on Western economies of the sanctions regime is, I think, something that will become much more significant in the months ahead. In the same foreign affairs piece, I think you say that inflicting material damage at the scale level against Russia cannot be pursued without economic support to those affected by the sanctions. And you talk about the need to protect the well-being of households through what you call compensatory policies. If that doesn't happen, you suggest the political support for sanctions will crumble over time. But my sense is that the kind of political discussion on compensatory policies, to the extent that it's there, is still quite reactive and nationally based. You know, certain countries are doing certain things and trying to help their citizens, but it's not really coordinated at a global level in the same way that the sanctions have been coordinated at a global level. Do you see that changing? And if not, what do you think the implications will be?
Well, I mean, I think you have an even more direct insight into this than I do, Ed, because of your experience, you know, up close with the Eurogroup and Eurozone finance ministers. But yeah, my sense is that there are existing obstacles to a long-term kind of paradigm shift in that regard, right? These fundamentally are finance ministers serving domestic interests. And the French, always, you know, the most grandiose and forward-looking, in these debates. But in Northern Europe, I think there is really this issue, and it, on the face of it, rationally makes little sense, because Germany or the Netherlands, where I'm from, these are extremely open trade-dependent economies. Yep. So if anyone should realize, right, that some kind of common compensatory mechanism for a fiscal stimulus would benefit them, because it puts a floor in demand,
yep,
for their most important trading partners and export markets, it should be them. And yet domestically, this argument is incredibly difficult to make. And I mean, it's an ongoing effort to try and make it. But the risk, I think, is quite serious. And also, I was talking a while ago to a journalist in Brussels who mentioned that actually the first week that the sanctions were imposed, Ursula von der Leyen's office at the European Commission had drafted a study, a kind of private set of economic estimates about the full damage to the European economy of a full severance of trade with Russia.
Yeah.
And the GDP number, that the GDP shock, was deemed so large that they chose not to reveal the number. And
my
all
goodness.
Journalists were actually in Brussels trying to scoop each other, trying to get this document.
Wow.
But so this was during the debate over extending the sanctions in the first 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm.
And it, you know, the potential damage estimates were really smothered and kept off the table.
Mm.
I think that, you know, to respond to Russian aggression this way, there is a case for doing that. But at least then, in the long run, you should actually, behind closed doors, realize the damage is going to be considerable and we must take these measures, even if it's just for, you know, sustaining the political support for these sanctions.
Sure.
Let alone, of course, like the actual macroeconomic effects. But I think that that's now where we're in this difficult zone, right, where people are throwing estimates around, and then the people who are in favor of intensifying sanctions say that the estimates are too big, or the damage will be much smaller than expected.
Mm.
I think it's, given the overreaction by the private sector, safe to assume that the damage will probably be larger than we expect, and so plan for that.
You think so?
Well, I mean, it will definitely be quite likely, if there's a full severance, a full cutoff of Russian energy imports, for example, I think the large Eurozone economies are quite likely to go into at least mild recession.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, Europe is really on the front line of this, obviously, because of its you know, its proximity to Ukraine and its reliance on Russian energy. And you've very strongly made the case that really it's impossible for, you know, an open kind of trade reliance block like Europe to have a prolonged imposition of trade reducing sanctions without a fiscal union. But I mean, as you know, and as I know, the discussion on a fiscal union in Europe is nowhere near where it needs to be. And I'm not even sure that the issues are kind of understood, certainly by policymakers, as being in any way aligned. You know, when we hear about fiscal union, we hear about it more in terms of spending on maybe, you know, defense and climate, you know, investment in the energy transition, things like that. We don't really ever hear it being talked about as kind of something that would be a necessary component of fighting a long economic war with Russia. Do you see any shift in that, or in any conversations you're having, or in any, you know, interactions you're having? I certainly don't see it in any conversations I'm having.
No, so far, unfortunately, not enough. But who knows what, you know, the continuation of these measures is going to bring. In the long run, I think there's a kind of interesting interaction between economic war and war economics.
Okay.
So when you start one, ultimately you end up usually with the other as well.
Right.
And obviously there's reasons, I think, why our policymakers probably underestimate the intensity of this economic war that they've initiated. But I think that it will become clear that more and more interventions are going to be needed. And Germany is, of course, already beginning to ration energy use quite substantially.
Well, the rationing of energy use, I think, is particularly interesting. And it actually kind of, you know, leads to kind of one of my final questions, which is around this whole issue of sacrifice and the politics of sacrifice. So if we look at what's happened, you know, very strong, unprecedented action was taken by Western states. You know, they perhaps didn't fully figure out or think through the kind of the purpose of that, the war aims of that economic war. We then have this issue about, as you very, intriguingly put it, the kind of interaction of an economic war and war economics, and a kind of maybe a command and control economy that arises in a wartime situation. But the other side of that is citizens and their perception of things, and the potential that sanctions fatigue may become a factor in Western political economies. So I think this is behind the lack of political appetite for an immediate boycott of Russian hydrocarbons. I think it's based to a large extent on public opinion. And in Germany recently, I looked at the polls, and like, while support for Ukraine and the war, the support for Ukraine is very strong, the willingness to tolerate material sacrifices in pursuit of this is lower and weakening. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how sanctions fatigue and, you know, the unwillingness of Europeans to sacrifice their material well-being in support of the war plays into this picture and what the political consequences of that might be.
Well, I think maybe what stands out most strongly concerning this issue is just the opportunities that we've missed in the last decade to avoid ending up in exactly the situation we're in right now.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you and I both and many others have been calling for much more aggressive fiscal stimulus mm-hmm. now for a while, precisely so that you can do things like accelerate the transition to renewable energy. And that would have been a great thing to have already done at scale before, so that we wouldn't now be in this situation where the costs of very rapidly cutting down Russian hydrocarbons are much more substantial. The other thing is that it would hopefully create a kind of positive dynamic between fiscal stimulus, higher incomes, rising tax revenues, and more domestic demand-driven economies in the Eurozone. The Eurozone, since the 2010s, has really become much more German-like in its balance of payments, right? It, almost all the economies, even the southern European ones, now have a current account surplus.
Yeah.
So they're all very dependent on exports and trade, and that just sets you up to be hit very badly by the mass use of sanctions. So I think it's going to have to go one of two ways. Either there's going to have to be serious coordinated efforts by European governments to move towards such a more domestic demand-driven economy, and then you can sustain these measures. And I think then you can avoid sanctions fatigue because people can see that there's more happening in their own countries and they're less in need of these foreign sources of energy. Or you don't do that, but then I think sanctions fatigue is probably inevitable.
And the only way to get around it in the second, scenario you describe is much greater fiscal coordination and fiscal capacity and a fiscal union, essentially.
Yes, exactly. So I think that this question is going to continue to be posed with increasing urgency.
So between a potential future of Europe where it's an autarky or a fiscal union, that is probably the long-term kind of political and economic choice we see arising for this, and perhaps to return to Adenauer, choices that maybe cannot be or will not be possible to be avoided for very much longer. Nicholas Mulder, it has been absolutely fascinating and really, really wonderful to speak to you about this subject. It is the subject, I think, of the moment. It's a subject that probably has not been as well understood as it needs to be. And your work and your research and your writing really helped shed light on it. So I'm very grateful to you. Thank you for a wonderful conversation.
It's a pleasure to be in conversation, Ed. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.